Back again to the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Saturday, February 7th, 2015. This is podcast number 390. And with me is my sometime co-host, Kai. This was intended to be either the last podcast or close to the last podcast. And I have utterly failed at that. I started putting notes together for a final podcast, and it ended up just going off the rails, and so that's what you're about to hear. So this is not going to be the final podcast. This is just going to be off the rails. I have a high level of frustration with people who call themselves libertarians and people who call what it is that they do or what it is that they're a part of, they call that the liberty movement. And, you know, we started making fun of that phrase, I think, about 3 years ago, and it bled over to the Freedom Fiends. Nima and Michael over there started making fun of the phrase liberty movement because, you know, we kind of inferred a movement is something you do in the bathroom at a given time every day. And we kind of inferred, you know, we kind of made fun of the liberty movement like that. Starting back several years ago, and it got to the point of where, you know, it doesn't matter how much we mock the stupidity and the silliness and the lack of organization and the lack of goals and the lack of any kind of direction. People who refer to what they're doing as the liberty movement keep getting worse and worse and worse. And, Kai, we haven't really talked about this. Do you know what happened with the folks over at the Center for Stateless Society not long ago? Are you aware of any of that that went on?
Not that comes to mind.
All right. I'm not going to get into it because it's disgusting, but one of the founding members of the Center for Stateless Society, on Facebook decided to admit to some really hideous activity. And that involved a victim, and he was so callous that he chose to even name the victim, and then sort of like it was his confession on Facebook was really disgusting, and then he just disappears, and nobody knew if he killed himself or if he turned himself into the police or if he just was running away or if his account got hacked and none of it was true. Nobody knew, and there was literally a couple of days of crazy speculation as to what was going on. The morning that took place, his confession took place late in the evening. The next morning, I woke up, didn't know anything about it, opened my email, and I had like 20 some emails telling me about it and complaining and going, you know, kind of people going nuts over it. And within a little while, it was over 30 emails just on that one topic. And I should say, I have two emails. One is more private and very few people know that email address. And the other is badquaker@badquaker.com. And that's the public one. That's the one that I say on the air. And that's the one that is, you can find it on the website, although maybe not anymore. We've purged a lot of stuff from the website. But, so these waves of email were coming into my personal email account that very few people know. And so very quickly it was over 30 emails, then it was over 40 emails, then it was over 50 emails just on this one topic. And the emails went, they've covered the whole spectrum from, you know, what is happening? Is this really this guy's confession, or did somebody hack the account? And, you know, it went from that to, hey, I live 3 hours away. What do you think about if I drive over there and kill him? And I'm like, dude, you're saying that to me in email. Think for a second, you know? And everything in between that. And so some of these emails, as soon as I would read them, I just delete them, because it was like, I don't even want to admit that I read that, much less respond to it, you know? And others were different phases in the spectrum of this. And the whole thing, not only do we have this individual at the Center for Stateless Society who was a disgusting human being, and I might say, as it turns out, he really is a disgusting, horrible piece of trash that should have been stomped into the earth a long time ago. But I cut this guy off, like, I don't know, around 2011 or 2000, yeah, probably 2011 or so. He had asked me to get involved in the Center for Stateless Society, and I checked out some of his writings, and I was like, so we had a slight technical difficulty there. We have to cut out and get back to the non-topic that I was ranting about. Anyway, so the guy contacted me, I think, about 2011 and asked if I wanted to be a contributor and get involved with Center for a Stateless Society. I checked out some of his writings, and I essentially told him, look, do you really believe the things that you write? Because he was, you know, off the board on the leftist side, anti-capitalist ranting, and I was like, you know, you understand that what you're calling capitalism is not capitalism, right? And he essentially admitted that he knew that, you know, that he was using terminology incorrectly, but it was what people understood, and he wanted to perpetuate. He wanted to use the terminology that would get people to think the way he wanted them to think. And I was like, no, you know, I like the truth, and therefore I'll have nothing to do with you. And so I cut him off, and like, way back then, it was like 2011, 2012. And that was it. He was done. I was, as far as I was concerned, you know, he was out there with the Rand Institute and, you know, the Koch brothers and, you know, I'm done with him. So he's gone. He's out of my life. He's out of my mind, and I don't think about him anymore. And what I don't understand then is when it turns out several years later that the guy is a complete flake and he's, you know, a bad person and everything. Everybody's shocked. It's like, oh, how can this be? How can he be that evil? How can he be that bad? Well, you know, then you go back, and a lot of people did this. A lot of people went back and looked at his previous posts, jokes that he had made, comments that he had made, and his twisted, perverted tendencies were right there for everybody to see. And yet they couldn't see them. And now, once it comes out, he admits to what kind of a monster that he was. A child, I haven't said it, but he's a child abuser. He's a child rapist. Now, once this information comes out, and people go back and they look at his earlier posts, and they're like, he was a disgusting human being. He was really vile and just a horrible person. Yes, and you people let him dwell among you for years. You people kept him on your friends list on Facebook and chatted with him for years. Now you tell me that he's evil? I cut him off a long time ago. And then, and some people pointed this out, you know, we got this guy up there in the Free State Project that technically he's not a part of the Free State Project. But he's given a microphone and put on a coast-to-coast radio show, and he has said stuff exactly like what this guy from Center for the Stateless Society, Anyway, this guy in New Hampshire has said identical stuff, made the same kinds of sick, perverted jokes. On top of that, he's been closely connected with several people who got busted with police and situations like that, where, you know, where there's suspect that he might have been involved in at least mole type activity or ratting them out possibly. And you let that guy stay among you. You didn't learn the lesson from Center for Stateless Society, dude. You let this other guy stay among you. Why? I look at this and I just shake my head. I think, I don't want to be associated with any of these people. What is there that that draws my, you know, and right in the middle of this, and I'll just rant a little bit further because this is kind of an angry rant. Right in the middle of all this, I get an email from the Free State Project from people up there, and they're like, "Hey, Ben, you know, you've been a longtime supporter of the Free State Project. We're having the Liberty Forum is coming up here real soon. And we wanted to know if you wanted to contribute and be a supporter for the Liberty Forum." And I pop over to the Liberty Forum's website. You've got representatives there from the Koch brothers, and you're asking me for money? Is this a joke? You have people there speaking who represent the Koch brothers, and you have the audacity to ask me for money. Go away. You are as far from, it's like asking me for money for the George W. Bush Presidential Library or for the Hillary Clinton campaign. You have the audacity to ask me for money when you support the Koch brothers or when you associate with them in that manner? What do I have in common with people like this? What do I have in common with people who would give a stage to somebody from the Koch brothers? I have nothing in common with you. You are literally my enemy. You are as much my enemy as if George W. Bush or his brother Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton or, you know, it's the same thing. And this point in time in 2015, you don't get that. You still put microphones in front of people like this. I have nothing to do with these people. And I look for the day that my name is completely disassociated with all of this. Now, that's the angry rant. Let's see, Kai, I have not allowed you to hardly even speak. But let's see if we can take this back to some kind of a civilized level where that you and I can talk and get away from some of this stuff. So what's going on, Kai?
Oh, not much. I'm pretending to be a citizen of the real world for a minute. And it's been interesting to be immersed in sort of American modern culture again. I don't know if you saw, but speaking of, you know, like, why do you put a microphone in front of these people? I watched a bunch of YouTube stars interview President Obama.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Well, and actually, it was, they asked a lot harder questions than I've heard any media ask of him. Like, they specifically asked him his thoughts on the shooting in Missouri, and they asked him why he was drone bombing children, and, like, not in those words, but pretty much in those words. And, like, there were certain bits where Obama was not very happy and really, like, dodged questions pretty viciously. It was very interesting to watch. But what I thought was interesting about the whole thing was that the media response to it was to immediately begin attacking the YouTube stars for being YouTube stars. They didn't talk about any of the things that they asked questions about. Like, they literally just attacked these people for being on YouTube. And it kind of sparked this whole, like, online media versus internet battle that's been raging for a couple of weeks now, about a week now. And it's been very interesting to watch because a lot of young people are not very happy with mainstream media right now. And actually, one of the YouTube stars pointed out that CNN's, I think it was CNN's, median age of viewer was 65.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I
used to be very positive about these things, and I used to think, you know, essentially all we have to do is let this generation of old people die and the world will get better. But I'm not convinced of that. This situation that happened, and with me, you know, I'm not even on Facebook. I'm not in there in these conversations following all this nonsense. I'm just, you know, I'm in the background catching flack from it at a distance. And still, you know, I look at that and I think all of my hope in the past has been that these old statists are all going to die eventually. And it was kind of like, you know, the Doors had that song where they said they got the guns, but we got the numbers, you know, and eventually we're taken over. And that was the kind of the point of the song was, you people have control today, but you know what? You're getting older every day and you're dying every day. And eventually we're going to be in control.
And but it doesn't work that way because like for instance, with this whole debate, it appears on the surface to be, you know, young media on the internet, not controlled by the government, you know, attacking established media. But that's not true. Like the majority of the sponsors for the people who were on YouTube interviewing the president were people like PBS and, you know, and YouTube itself, which is owned by Google. So we're talking about corporate media here, no matter how you slice it. But it's a corporate media that has learned to put on the disguise of young people, you know, because several of the YouTube stars were like any of them that actually asked real questions were like 40, you know? So it's not like they're actually in the young generation, but they shape it by saying, okay, well, here's a problem. Here's something that's obviously going to be an issue. Let's just infiltrate and redirect everybody's attention over here, you know? And it's the same thing that they did in the 60s. The youth of the 60s were upset. They saw this culture that was unsustainable and not heading in the way that they wanted it to go. And so they started a revolution, but immediately got sidetracked by drugs. Yeah. You know, it's the exact same thing that happened. And now we're seeing, okay, so there's this little bit of a media revolution. Okay, well, they're immediately going to be sidetracked by some corporate media that's just learned to dress differently and is young and hip now.
Are you tapping out Morse code on something? Are you sending like a subliminal message to someone in Morse code there?
I'm literally not touching anything. I am like hunched into a little tiny ball so as not to touch any of the electronics around me and talking directly into the microphone.
Because it literally sounds like you're tapping Morse code on something like tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat. I don't know. It's weird. You know, we talked about this.
Scrutinizer.
Yeah, actually, we talked about this before we started recording. That this is one of the reasons why Michael Dean over at Freedom Fiends has developed Fiend Phone, because you know if you're using Skype, which we're using Skype today, because Kai is stuck on a magic happy computer made by Apple, so it's so cute and so pretty and it's got pretty colors and it's stupid and doesn't work. But so Fiend Phone doesn't work on Apple because you know because Apple's stupid. So we're stuck using Skype, and using Skype means that you're using a set of software that's developed, that's owned by Microsoft, which means it has all kinds of things running in it that don't need to be running. And it's assuming that, you know, I'm amazed that Clippy doesn't pop up in the middle of Skype saying, it looks like you're trying to make a phone call. Are you trying to make a phone call? You know, because the Clippy is the epitome of what's wrong with all things Microsoft, even though Clippy has been, you know, dead and gone for what, 10 years now or something. I can't help but to believe that Clippy is hidden in all Microsoft products, just waiting. You know, the ghost of Clippy is waiting to come out, and a zombie Clippy is waiting to come out and take over or something. But the other thing is that all things going through Skype also have to go through Utah. And are slowed down and messed with through the processes of the giant, computer drives that are in Utah and the NSA's, place there. And so all that, even though we're not saying anything that we want to keep secretive or whatever, it still has to go through the NSA's filters. And that slows the message down, slows the electrons as they're racing through the wires, I'm talking about, not the necessarily the message that we're saying. But it slows everything down, and it provides the wonderful clicking sounds and hissing sounds and toilet flushing sounds and all the nonsense that comes through using Skype. It's very frustrating if you're trying to actually make something that sounds halfway decent. And what's the alternative? Oh, we could go to Google Circles and, you know, get even worse sound with that. That's great. That's a good idea there. And trust Google instead of Microsoft. Wow, that's a good idea.
I, for one, would like Google to know that I am in favor of Google, and I have been a loyal servant since day one. And when they rule the world, I would like very much to be, you know, a house slave, not a field slave. I've been a good Google drone.
I, for one, welcome our Google overlords. Before we go on too far into all this nonsense, let's go ahead and I'm going to go ahead and hit my notes that I had put together for today, even though, so let me fill in our audience so that they know what sort of where all this ranting is coming from and so forth. I am, as any listeners should know by now, I am in the process of closing down the podcast. It was our intention, it was the intention of Kai and myself today to do either the final podcast or close to the final podcast and wrap up some of the final things that I wanted to talk about. Specifically, I wanted to talk about, oddly enough, you know, the nature of God. How do I view God? What do I think of when I think of God? How do I view Scripture? Is the Bible the absolute Word of God? Is the King James Version of the Bible the absolute Word of God? I wanted to talk about some of these things in the final podcast. I also wanted to talk about, what the end of the state is going to look like. And there's two possible ends. I believe, and this is faith-based, I believe that in the end, good wins. I believe that. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be working on what I perceive to be the good side. I believe in the end the state will die. I believe that. I believe there's evidence to support that. But I also believe that a possible ending for the state is complete annihilation of the human race. And I think that is the goal of the state. I think the state, and again, I shouldn't have to go through this, but let's just talk about the difference here. Government, and we have this limitation of the human, of the English language. And the difference between what I'm calling the state and what I'm calling the government, there's a vast difference between the two. So I want to make this clear yet again. Government is the guys in robes and the guys with badges and the guys that drive around military equipment and kill people, and the airplanes that fly over and kill people, and the guys in bunkers that control drones, and the people with their statues on the sides of mountains, and, you know, all those guys in government that pretend to make laws and enforce the laws and interpret the laws and play with the laws and argue about the laws, and all of that is government, and all those people at the mayor's office and all those people at the police station and all those people at the coroner's office and all those people are government. But the state is the religion that people believe that makes them think that all of that stuff is not only necessary but good and right. And that I believe to be the state. The state literally is the religion, the mythology that surrounds government and that makes people believe that government is a good or necessary required thing. And I believe that, you know, if enough people believe that Thor is an actual deity and he has a hammer and he lives in the clouds and he makes thunder and you know, that he comes to your aid in battle, if enough people believe that, then they will act based on those beliefs. And as they act based on those beliefs, in a very real sense, Thor becomes real because Thor is what they are basing their actions upon. So if they really believe that Thor is real and they act accordingly and they incorporate that into every aspect of their life, in a very real sense, Thor is real. Thor takes on a personality and Thor begins to actually be a thing. Now, whether you can go and stick your finger in Thor is not the point. The point is that somebody believes it enough that their actions are influenced by this thing. Now, that's my contention with the state. The state is real. It is a real thing because so many people invest so much of their life in making it real. It can't help but to be real. And it will continue to be real so long as people have that level, that intensity of faith. And that's really what it is. It's faith. Faith in the government makes the state real and gives the state the ability to develop, to conquer, to, you know, the state has changed dramatically in the last, 8, 9, 10,000 years. The state has shifted. It has morphed. It has gone through dramatic changes. And in the last 100 years, the state has come into a new sense of itself. And it might even have a will. It might even have a sense of its own destiny. I mean, I don't know where you draw the line in a make-believe God of where it goes from just being something that people think about and act based on those thoughts into being an actual thing that has power and has its own individual thoughts and so forth. I don't know where you draw the line on this thing, but if you look at the characteristics, if you set aside, if you use your imagination and you set aside the actual physical realm that we look at and we see things and we touch things, and you say, what is the nature of this beast that we call the state? What is this thing doing, and what is it like, and what is its nature, and how does it act, and how is it metamorphosizing, and how is it changing, and what direction is it going, and what is its purpose? And you start to wonder if it is an actual man-made, created God. And I think it is. I think it has a personality. I think it exists in every way, the way that in ancient times, you know, people believed in different kinds of mythology, and they based their whole lives around it. And I think the state has taken on that role. And I think a lot of people who call themselves Christians have in their mind what they believe to be God. And I believe that in reality, their efforts and their entire vision of God really is just a version of the state. I'm not saying all Christians, I'm not lumping everybody together, everyone who has faith, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if you walk into the average American church and you see flags on the walls and you see them having ceremonies for veterans and you have all this stuff, all this pomp and ceremony that goes with statism, I'm really starting to become convinced that American Christianity is just an aspect of statism. And so where was I taking all that? Oh, yeah. So that was going to be, maybe in a sense I'm doing it now, but that was going to be the final podcast, was talking about this stuff and then talking about my vision. And I say that, I use that word intentionally, my vision of what the end is going to look like. I probably should go ahead and touch it since we're on the topic. So, years ago, we're talking 2010 or so. No, maybe earlier than that, 2009. Yeah, I'm thinking like 2009, something like that. I was out in my backyard in my garden and just kind of rolling these things around in my mind. And what came to me, I'm going to assume is a vision. Now, I don't know, you know, exactly what, if you take some biblical prophet who saw a vision, and it's written in the Bible that this biblical prophet saw a vision. Let's take John, who was the assumed to be the author of the book of Revelation. So John describes his visions in the book of Revelation. Now, I don't know exactly what happened with that particular individual, and I don't know, you know, if that guy's vision was where he physically saw things with his eyes and he saw events happening, and I don't know that, or if it was just pictures in his mind. you know, the guy was tortured horribly, and there's possibility that he was exposed to some fairly strong narcotics, and there possibly some magic mushrooms. That's a possibility. There's a possibility that none of that's true and that he was just seeing a vision from God. And there's a possibility that really what he was just doing is thinking things out logically and saying, where does this all end? Where does this go and where does it all end? And I've made the argument before that, you know, if you do just sit down on some riverbank and you think and you really just start saying, if this happens, what will this be like? And if that happens, what will that be like? And if you do that long enough, eventually your mind begins to create a picture of what things could be like. And I think, and I don't know this to be an absolute fact, but I think that's what prophecy is. Now, it could be God coming down and touching a person's mind and giving them a vision. But I think even if you don't believe that there is such a thing as God, if you realize that humanity is the product of some very complicated processes, even if you don't believe in God, if you just understand that whatever processes got humanity to where it is now, it's some very, very complicated processes that the human mind can't even begin to fathom. And to think that we as humans have complete understanding of what it is that creates us, what it is that makes us what we are, that's pretty childish to assume that. So I think the mature way of thinking is to make the assumption that we simply don't know and can't know how we got to where we are. Why is it that we're not, you know, swirling in pond scum somewhere, just trying to replicate ourselves? How is it that we're not there? And I think the human mind is not capable of fully understanding all of the aspects of that. But I can imagine that if you do what I said, you sit on a riverbank and you just quietly sit in the shade and you just contemplate things, if you do that long enough with enough peace in your mind and not influenced by other things that are happening around you, I think that you can actually bring your mind to follow things through and get a glimpse of things that are bigger than you yourself can think of on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's what prophecy is. And I think that's what a vision is. And I think that's what happened to me in my garden. But whatever the explanation of what happened in that garden, maybe it was just the result of too many head injuries. Maybe it was the result of, you know, being in the sun too much, or maybe, who knows? I mean, you could give any kind of an example. But what I saw in that vision is a very scary future. You know, if you look, I'll use a movie reference. This will make it easy. If you watch the Terminator movies, you have a situation where the very first Terminator movie, you have this lady, and she's just, you know, she's a waitress, and she's going through her life, and everything's just a typical waitress life, and everything's going on. And this guy comes back from the future that turns out to be a friend of her son from the future. Her son that she still, you know, she's not even, hasn't had a son yet or anything. But in the future, she has a son, and in the future, that son makes a friend, and that friend comes back from the future to try to save her because a machine from the future has also come back from the future and is attempting to kill her. So that's the point of the first, Terminator movie. Now, she falls in love with this guy, and she ends up getting pregnant from this guy, and then he ends up getting killed, and the machine gets killed as well. And so she has a baby, and that baby will grow up into the future and make friends with a friend who will then come back from the future. And so it's kind of a weird circular logic that takes place in order to make this movie happen. And there's some real logical flaws in the process of the movie, but it's very entertaining. Now, in the second movie, and keep in mind that nowhere in any of these movies does she ever actually go to the future. She never does any time travel at all in her entire life. She doesn't do time travel. So in the second movie, her son is a little bit older, and she has been attempting to train him so that he will be ready for this future war that's coming. And in doing that, it's assumed that she's crazy. I mean, you know, bats in belfry, off for rocker, completely mad. And so she's institutionalized, and he's put in a foster home. And he's growing up to be a real jerk. And out of the future comes back a machine to save his life and try to keep him alive, while another machine from the future is coming back to try to kill him. And in this movie, in the second Terminator movie, it shows her having these dreams and having this vision of the future of what's coming and what it's going to be like. And it is so vividly real to her that it literally almost drives her insane. If it wasn't for the fact that she is trying to get out of the mental hospital to save her son, she would actually be pretty crazy. And she's, dangerous to the people that are around her. And the reason why is because she has this vivid vision of the future of what's going to take place. Now, again, she never actually did any time traveling, so she doesn't know that to be the case. She only believes it to be the case because of the dramatic things that she's already seen. She has not seen the future. She has only seen evidence that what she's been told about the future will happen. And yet, in her mind, there exists a vision of the future that is so vivid that it practically drives her insane. And I kind of feel that prophecy is like that. I kind of feel that visions of the future are not always correct. You know, there are some crazy people that regularly make crazy assumptions about the future. I read, if you go back and you read, Tesla did an interview in the 1930s. And if you read that interview with Tesla, and a lot of liberty-minded people are kind of fascinated with Tesla because he's a pretty fascinating person. But Tesla also had an evil side, and he envisioned a purging of the human race and a killing off of all the bad people in society. In that sense, he was a product of the around the turn of 1900s. In that area, there were a lot of prominent people who honestly believed that humanity would that there would need to be a controlled purging of humanity to get all these bad people out of the gene pool. And Tesla fit that twisted version of humanity. Anyway, but if you read this interview that Tesla did, he had all these ideas. What's the future going to be like? And he was maybe one of the smartest people alive in the 1930s. And that's saying a lot, considering there were some pretty smart people around in the 1930s. And yet you read Tesla's vision of the future, and it's laughable. It's so incredibly wrong. Because he makes these assumptions that his inventions are going to be utilized to stop all war, which is just the opposite. You know, he fails to understand the number one thing in all of humanity that is affecting why there is or isn't war, and that's government. He fails to take that into consideration. He fails to take into consideration what the nature of government is, and he didn't understand this variation of what I'm talking about, the difference between state and government. He didn't understand any of that. So his entire vision of the future is based on this flawed idea, and it's just laughable. None of the things that he says are going to take place. None of those things actually took place, and war didn't go away like he believed it would. Mankind didn't evolve ahead and to the point of where he didn't need war, and no great machine was ever invented that made war obsolete. None of the things that Tesla thought were going to happen actually happened, because Tesla was only looking at it through the eyes that he had in his head, and he couldn't see any further than that. And I think that's what prophecy is. The difference is, you know, some people think about more of these aspects, and other people don't. So you read, go back to John in the author of Revelation. You read his version of the future, and you think, well, first off, he wrote it in such a way that, like Nostradamus or like a lot of other people writing about the future. He wrote it in such a way that you could pretty much interpret it any way that you wanted. And there's no time frames in it, so you can't say, well, this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. It's not written like that. So if you're going to talk about a vision of the future, the way to make it sound eternal and the way to make generations from now go back and read it and go, wow, that guy really knew what was going to happen. You put it in such a way that it can be so vague that it can be translated in any way. That's the key of reading. What's the guy I just said a second ago from France?
Nostradamus.
Yeah, that's the key in reading Nostradamus, is everything he said could be interpreted for every generation. You know, every generation there's a city on a river, and every generation something dramatic happens. So, you know, that's the thing with John writing Revelation, is that you can interpret it any way that you want. And so now I'm taking this back to when I was in my garden and the things that rolled into my mind and the future that I saw there. I'm not going to say that I'm smarter than Tesla, or that I have greater vision than Nostradamus, or than, you know, greater than John, who was a close associate of Jesus. I'm not going to try to put myself in that kind of category. All I'm going to say is I was a guy who was working in the garden, and I have been thinking about this stuff for decades, and some thoughts came into my head, and I thought, I have to say these things, and I don't care if anybody listens, or I don't care if they listen and are offended, or I don't care if they listen and think I'm crazy. At some point, I have to say these things, because that's where my responsibility ends. My responsibility, I saw this, and I have to speak it. And if I'm wrong, or if I'm, you know, if it's brain damage that's talking, or if I'm right, it doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter. My only responsibility is to say it, and then people can do with it whatever they want. Throw it away. Don't listen to it. Write me off as crazy. Whatever you want to do. I don't care. My responsibility ends when my voice stops. So that's what the Bad Quaker podcast has been since 2011. It has been me beating around the bush, not telling what I saw in that garden.
So what did you see in the garden?
I saw the end of the state. Now, when I say the end of the state, I mean the religion, the myth, the God, the Antichrist, the beast, die. That's what I saw. The question is, do we survive? Does humanity survive? Do humans live after the state dies? And I don't know the answer to that. It's going to be close. It literally could go either direction. But I know this, you know, by looking at the nature of government, and by looking at the nature of people who perpetuate government, and looking at the basis of how the way that they act, the way that they behave, the what they are willing to do to hold power. And then I read stuff like, you know, there's so many people who call themselves libertarians who write about, oh, well, you know, all we have to do is just vote for this guy and vote for that guy, and we'll, you know, reduce the scope and size of government, and we'll get the Federal Reserve audited, and we'll, you know, stop invading foreign countries, and everything will be good. And, you know, I think that's a nice little Pollyanna world that you live in. Now wake up before they, you know, haul you out of your house by the ankles and show you what the state is really like. That, you know, that whole world of trying to use the government to fix the government is so nonsensical to me. I literally view those people as my enemy, because they are the ones who are attempting to put a leash around my neck and trying to put chains on my feet. They are the enemy, because they're the ones who are trying to convince me and everybody else that it's all right, that it's okay that we have these chains on us. It's okay that you have this leash. It's all right. All we have to do is just make it more comfortable and everything will be fine. And those people literally are the enemy, because they are, you mentioned, Kai, earlier the reference to, you know, the houseboy slave as opposed to the field slave. And they are literally attempting to be the houseboy slaves. That's what they are. They're attempting to convince the field slaves that things are not so bad. That, you know, all we have to do is wait and the master will innovate the cotton picking process and your lives will be much easier out there in the fields. All you have to do is just, you know, keep supporting the master and we'll get through this and it'll be much better in the future. And all they are doing is perpetuating slavery. They are trying to make slavery more comfortable for the rest of us. And that's my enemy. Those people who call themselves libertarians, who do that, are my enemy. As much so, like I said earlier, as George W. Bush or Hillary Clinton or any of those people. They are my enemy. They are the enemies of humanity. I believe they are attempting to further enslave us so that humanity will die. And I think that's the purpose of the state. It is literally the Antichrist. It is literally the opposite of the Creator. Whatever you imagine the Creator to be, state is the opposite. It is the thing that desires in every possible way to crush humanity. The freedom that individuals have in a natural setting, to eat, to not eat, to relax, to communicate, to trade with one another, to interact with one another, all on a voluntary basis. That is the nature of humanity. That is the true nature of humans in their natural state. And, for humans to attempt to dominate other humans is unnatural. And I think that's the essence of what is natural for humanity and what will eventually kill humanity. If you think about it, humans are the only animals that we know of that actually know that we're going to die. Like, all animals have a certain, do they really have a fear of death or do they have a fear of pain? You know, it's hard to tell. Do animals understand that they're actually going to die? Or do they just want to avoid pain? Why does the gazelle run away from the lion? Is it because he understands that the lion will kill him? Or is it because he has an inner fear of the pain that comes with getting, you know, savagely ripped apart by the lion? It's hard to tell, but humans do understand that we're going to die. And humans are the only animal that I know of that will intentionally kill themselves. And some might argue, well, what do whales do when they come up on the beach? The odds are they're just really confused. The odds are there's something in their lives, something in their environment that has confused them, and that's why they beach themselves. It's not because they want to kill themselves. But humans, on the other hand, actively try to kill themselves. Not always, but a significant portion of humans either accomplish suicide or they live a suicidal lifestyle that is on the brink of suicide. And that's what the state is. The state is humanity's attempt to kill humanity. And that's why I say it is the absolute enemy of humanity. And so back to my vision. The state will die. Now, there's two ways that the state can die. The state could get big enough and powerful enough that in internal struggles, because here's something that you can watch this on all levels of government. Government has a tendency to oppress people, but government has a tendency, even more than oppressing people, government turns on its own and eats its own. Government has a tendency to eat its own children. Those people who are the deepest followers of government and those people who are convinced most thoroughly that government is necessary for life, those people are the ones most likely to be killed by government first. Who are they? They are soldiers. They are people who live their entire life dependent upon a check from the government. They are politicians. Those people who are in the depths of government are more likely to be killed from government than people who are not. If you think about, you know, now let me clarify this, because like during the 20th century, the quantity of soldiers that died in the 20th century are nothing compared to the quantity of civilians that died, because you have like whole cities being bombed and whole cities being blown up by either conventional bombs or nuclear warfare and things like this. So you have a disproportionate number of humans being of civilians being killed as far as compared to soldiers being killed. But the people that lived in the cities that were bombed, Dresden, Nagasaki, you name the city, they actually were there in that city supporting the government. And I'm not saying that it was right to kill them. That's the exact opposite of what I'm saying. But I'm saying that they supported the government. That's why they were in that city. They were working every day. They were working in the, in the factories. They were providing, taxation, a tax base for the government to exist. They were not actively getting themselves separate from government. They were part of government. They were dependent upon government. And I'm not trying to blame the victims here. That's not my purpose. But what I'm saying is the people who depend on government and have faith in government are the ones that government typically kills. So, and you see this regularly, you see like, this guy, Brian Williams is the news dude. Have you followed what's been happening in the last few days with that guy?
Not at all.
So using Brian Williams as an example of this, Brian Williams is or was the main anchor of NBC nightly news. He's been called the most trusted newsman in America, which, to me, that's just laughable. But a lot of people really trust him. And as it turns out, since something like 2003, he's been repeating this lie that he was in this helicopter in Iraq, and the helicopter took enemy fire and was forced to land in an emergency landing. And at times he has told vivid aspects of this, of bullets going through the helicopter and things like this. At other times he's been more vague about it. But now, just in the last few days, it's come out that the entire thing was a lie. And he attempted to sort of lie his way out of the lie by saying, oh, well, I just misremembered it, and I just misspoke, and I just – and he uses all these Clinton-esque phrases to give a wink in an apology that says it wasn't quite that way, but it's really close. It's like Hillary Clinton telling about being shot at from running across the tarmac, running from a sniper in Bosnia or whatever. And that entire thing was an entire fabrication. It was all made up. Or, Bill Clinton lying about things and then coming back and saying, well, it's according to what the definition of is. And that kind of manipulation of language to try to worm his way out of the lie that he told. And then
I totally misremembered this horrible traumatic incident that it turned out didn't happen at all.
Yeah, and then he said, well, as it turns out, it happened to not the helicopter he was riding in, but the helicopter that was in a procession that he was in together, and they all came down and landed at the same time. And it was the other helicopter that was actually hit, and his helicopter wasn't actually hit. And then other people who were there at the time say, no, that's still a lie. That's not even close to what happened. And so the lie keeps being retold. And while they're doing this, like Whoopi Goldberg and other famous people are now ringing in on it. And they're in the process of eating their own. This is where I was taking this point. What he should do at this point is say, I was lying about the whole thing. I have a tendency to lie. It's my job to lie. That's what the NBC Nightly News is. It's lies. I work for the government in a sense. I'm part of this whole state monopoly, on information and on violence. And it's my job to use propaganda to convince people to think the way I want to think. And now I've been getting $10 million a year salary. That's his salary. I've been getting $10 million a year in salary. So now I'm going to thumb my nose at all you people and live on my private island and just enjoy the rest of my life. Goodbye. That's what he should do. If he had a soul, that's what he would do, and just go and enjoy his vast wealth and have a fun life for the rest of his life and forget about it. Of course, he won't do that.
Because if he had a soul, he wouldn't lie for a living.
Yeah, exactly. But what will happen eventually is he'll get replaced. He's being ostracized. He's going to be more and more isolated. He's going to lose more and more supporters. And eventually he'll resign his position at NBC and they'll put somebody else in there, and he'll wander off like other newsmen in the past that it's turned out they were frauds. And people forgot all about that within a couple of years. People forget all of these, every time this cycle of events takes place, and it takes place over and over and over, and they still don't remember it happening to the last news guy that this exact same thing happened to, because they tend to all be liars. Anyway, so that's my point, is that not to just pick on that one news slime, but the state has a tendency, as soon as it sees that that one of its own has a flaw, whether we're talking about some governor who attempts to do something crazy and ends up getting caught, and then they all fall on him and just devour him. Government is kind of like a school of piranha, where if one of them has a flaw, the others will immediately devour it. They will propagate themselves. They will continue to reproduce over and over and over. But the second one of them shows a little bit of a flaw, they'll all turn on it. They're like, they have feeding frenzies like sharks, and they don't care whether you're, how important you are on the inside. I mean, look at what they did to Nixon. Here's Nixon, the president of the United States, doing exactly what other presidents had done, and doing what even the president today, Barack Obama, is not doing is far beyond anything that Richard Nixon did. And yet they're not devouring him. But because because Nixon put some blood in the water, because they saw the flaw in him, they saw the weakness, the public saw it, and they fell on him and devoured him. And that's what they do to their own. And so eventually, I'm going to tie this up here in reference to the state. And then Kai, you had some things you wanted to talk about a little bit on karma and relating to this. So eventually my vision of the state is that it will get so strong and so powerful that it will more and more begin to consume itself, to the point of where it either, one of two things happens. Either it completely destroys humanity, and this is a very, very likely scenario, that government will get to the point of where somebody hits the wrong button, or somebody is mad at somebody, and it is a species-wide suicide. That's what government is. Government is the attempt of humans to kill humans, because deep down inside, humanity has this love-hate relationship with itself, and it dreads the moment that it's going to die, and in a very real sense, it can't wait for that moment so that the fight is over. And so humanity wants to kill itself, and that's what government is. Now, the other option for this, and it's the thing that I have hope. I don't know for a fact that this is going to happen, but I have hope. I have faith. I want to believe this. And that doesn't mean it's going to happen. That doesn't mean that I have a secret of the universe and I know for a fact that this is going to be the case. I don't know that. But I hope to this. I hope that at some moment, as the state is engulfing and devouring humanity, that some remnant of humanity will recognize what's happening and say, that's the problem. Belief in the state, that faith, that religion of statism is the problem. And that literally is the devil. It's an aspect of human nature that is Satan. It is the devil. It is the beast. It is the Antichrist. It is an aspect of humanity. And let's decide that we will reject it. And they take individually, not communally, individually, you reject it. And you literally turn to the light and away from that darkness that is the state, that is government, that is the devil, that is Satan. And in doing that, this small remnant of humanity, and this is the part of the vision that I hope happens, this small remnant of humanity turns its back on that dark faith and rejects it. and the state kills itself, literally kills every human being that supports it. And only a remnant is left alive, and they thoroughly understand how evil the state is, and they reject it completely. And then we live. And that's the thing that I hope for, is that there is. Now, I look in, like in you, I was talking about the Bible. I look at the prophecies in the Bible, and it appears as though other people, to me anyway, from my eyes, it appears to me that other people have thought this thing through and came to the same conclusion. And they have tried in the best that they could, given the resources that they had, to get this message into the Bible in some way. And there's this number that keeps coming up, and it appears to me that somewhere between 1 and 2/3 of humanity will die in the process of the state dying. The state will take anywhere from 1 to 2/3 of humanity with it when it goes. And it's going to be a global level of destruction. That is my vision of the future. It is very much what Sarah Connor sees in her vision of the future in Terminator. And I don't know about the numbers. One of the things that has always struck me, I've kind of had this running survey going in my mind since I was about 20. And I look around at the people around me and I think, and I've said this in different ways and different times, about 2/3 of the people around you at any particular time are idiots. Now, that's not to say they are always idiots. There are about 1/3 of humans that are full-time morons, that all every single day they're stupid. I mean, if you just run the numbers, if you just look at IQ numbers, about 1/3 of all people are pretty dumb. Now, because we have a very soft, cushy culture, there are ways that these stupid people can make, make a living and still live and survive and reproduce. And many of these dumb people are very nice people. You'd be perfectly happy talking to them and interacting with them, but they're idiots. Now, that doesn't mean they're bad. They're just not that bright. And so, but they're functional. They still function in society. So that's about 1/3 of all humanity, I think, are really, there's an old saying that if you think about it, half of people are below average intelligence. That's just numbers, right? Half of people are below average intelligence. That makes sense, right?
Right.
So it makes sense that about 1/3 of people are seriously dumb. Now, it's my belief that about 1/3 of the people always love government. About 1/3 of the people entirely exist because government exists. Without government, about 1/3 of humanity would, absolutely starve. They wouldn't be able to handle their life without government, without somebody there telling them what they can and can't do constantly. They would die. If for no other reason, they would do something stupid and somebody else would kill them, because they're trying to rob a house or some stupid thing like that. And they end up, someone else in humanity gets them out of the herd. And then I think about the rest of us, the 2/3 that are not complete idiots. And I'm speaking of myself in this context as well. About half the time, even though we're not an idiot, we act like an idiot. About half the time in my own life, I'm making bad decisions. I'm doing stupid things. So if we consider humanity and we realize that 1/3 of humanity are full-time morons and could not survive on their own, and then of the 2/3 that are left, about half of those, about another 1/3 of humanity, even though they're not full-time idiots, they're being an idiot at any particular time. So that means 2/3 of humanity are always being idiots. Only about 1/3 of humanity are actually thinking at any particular time. And so I come to these numbers and I realize that that's kind of works into this vision of the end of the state. At some point in time, when the state starts to devour its own in that kind of quantities, anywhere from 1/3 to 2/3 of humanity are going to suffer the consequences of the death of the state. And it's going to be very brutal, and there's going to be a lot of flames involved, and there's going to be a lot of death, and it's going to be a really, really horrific. It's just going to be terrible. And that's the future that I see. And if 1/3 can live, then I think we have a chance. And how will that be done? it's almost beyond imagination because it's, first off, it's not happening in this generation. It's absolutely not happening in this generation. Second, as much America-centric as Americans tend to be, it's not about the U.S. government. The U.S. government could fall tomorrow, and it does not affect this situation. The U.S., you know, we have so many people who call themselves libertarians that, their solution is going to be state by state and county by county and city by city and community by community. Secession happens, and somehow magically those monsters that are in control of government are just going to fold their arms and go, oh, you want to be separate? Okay, well, that's fine. And Texas is going to become its own country, and then Dallas will become its own country, and then counties and then communities and all these things will all separate out, and we'll have this wonderful libertarian utopia where every community sets its own standard, and that's a pipe dream that will never take place. That is absolute fantasy. If the U.S. government is alive and functioning, and there are still soldiers with guns, they will kill anybody who tries to secede. That is an established fact of history. The only way that that's going to happen is if the U.S. government is completely destroyed first. And that's not going to happen anytime within the next generation. So libertarian ideas of some kind of secession movement, you know, It's just a pipe dream. It's silliness. As long as the state exists, it will not let that happen. It will literally round you up and kill you before it lets that take place. So my vision then, to wrap this thing up, my vision is of this worldwide state has to die at once, at one time, in one killing, in one setting. It has to happen at once, and I think that's biblical. I think there's biblical support of the fact that, you know, and in one place it even says that all this devastation took place in one day, and people stand and look at it going, how could something like that be destroyed in one day? How could this happen? And I think it could. I think it could happen, maybe not in a 24-hour period, but I think it could happen so suddenly that when it happens, the remnant who are alive will stand back with their mouths gaping open and go, can you believe how fast the state devoured itself? Now, will there be anything left of Earth when this takes place? I don't know. You know, I really don't know. Will there be anything salvageable on this planet? I don't know. So now, Kai, what did you have to say about karma?
Well, and it kind of ties into all that. I just started out, you know, I enjoy playing chess. I like playing chess quite a bit. And in chess, the goal is to predict the future. When you get good at chess, what you are getting good at is looking through a series of events that might happen and figuring out how to get the event that you want to happen to happen. And so you're essentially learning to predict the future. And it's a very controlled future. There aren't a whole lot of variables. You know, there are only so many pieces and they can only move in so many directions. So it is easy to get your brain to the point where you can look at the pieces that are on the board and the way that they might move and how they might interact with each other and be able to come up with a somewhat accurate prediction of the future. And so this is the same thing that can happen with prophecy. What you're essentially doing is you're looking at the variables that you can see, and you're putting them together in a way that your mind sees as the most likely scenario to happen. And the way that each individual piece moves and then reacts to other pieces moving is kind of their karma. That's what karma is. People think that karma means like you're punished for doing bad things and you're rewarded for doing good things. But that's not really the idea of karma in Buddhist tradition, at least at any rate. And I know that there's several forms of this idea in different world religions, but it's essentially the consequences of your behavior. And so you can accurately judge what the future is going to look like based off of reasonable predictions of certain actions, you know. So if you say, okay, what is the long-term path that choosing the state is going to bring about? And you can pretty accurately see that because we have a pretty good model of how states interact and what happens to them at certain levels in their histories. You know, we've got a pretty good track record of what happens to the state. And eventually, the state always falls in some violent, horrible manner. And that just kind of happens. And this is because most of the time, a new state has come in. But if you look in areas where the state hasn't had a different state come in, where in fact it has just sort of crumbled apart because the people in it no longer found it useful, that gives me hope for a future model that's based off of, you know, nonviolence. And I have hope for that because in my mind, when I read like the Book of Revelations, I don't necessarily see so much an external view of the world as I see an internal world. When you let go of your need for the state, that's not easy. Like in your brain to get yourself to that point where you're free. And you go through a lot and there's anger and there's violence and there's this isn't fair and there's a stripping away of veils so that you can see how awful and terrible this thing really is. And it makes you feel hopeless. But you have to go through that to get to what is on the other side of that, which is a stateless world, you know, and I don't necessarily know that those prophecies are an actual this will happen, but maybe a, you know, maybe one third of people won't choose to be able to make it through that pathway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they just, I think that they will probably destroy themselves, not necessarily through aggressive action, but sort of an internal struggle, you know. And we're seeing that so much more nowadays anyway. You know, rates of addiction are skyrocketing, and when you have an area that's heavily statist, rates of addiction are always higher because you are in such an unnatural state that you have become a prisoner in your mind, and when that happens, your whole system rebels. You know, your whole mental system will drive you to insanity to get you out of that situation. And if you can break free of it mentally, then you can break free of all of that self-destruction, you know?
I'm doing this series with Michael and the Freedom Fiends about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. and relating that to statism. And, you know, actually people made this comparison several years ago and tried to get me to see it. And I was like, yeah, yeah, 12 steps, uh-huh, yeah. The state's an addiction, I get it. State's an addiction, I get it. But I never really got it until Michael said, I want to do a series of shows where we focus on each of these steps and compare them to statism. And I had to sit down and actually study this stuff. And then, you know, I began to see what other people had been telling me for a long time was that statism is an actual addiction. And that one of the ways to overcome that addiction is through a tried and tested means, which is following these 12 steps. And then you start to examine these 12 steps and you start to realize that, yeah, you actually, it's kind of like any kind of addiction that you are dealing with, you have to go through these processes. There's, it's not like, oh, here's a way. It's like, you know, losing right. weight. It's like, well, I could go to the gym and exercise, or I can reduce my calorie intake, or I can reduce my carbs, or I can reduce my fat, or I can, you know, or I can take this magic supplement, or, and all of those are gimmicks that may or may not work. But when it comes to addiction, what I'm really seeing is these 12 steps, it doesn't matter what the addiction is, these 12 steps are the only logical path to deal with an addiction.
And you know, just like other things, you know, with addictions, one third to two thirds of the time, people don't make it through the recovery process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not an external thing. That's an internal thing.
Yeah. And I was kind of being harsh talking about, you know, a third of humanity are idiots, but, you know, define that any way you want. You could also say a third of all addicts are never going to be able to deal with their addiction and they're going to die of it, you know? And a third are going to struggle, and they're going to struggle and struggle and struggle, and maybe they will, and maybe they won't make it through. And then a third are just going to go, yeah, okay, I'm going to drop that, and it's not a problem for them, you know. It's a very different. It's kind of like there's a line in the movie, what is the name? Beetlejuice. There's a line in Beetlejuice where they have gone into the waiting room to try to get some assistance from the dead people, you know, in the afterlife. And one of the main characters says to their caseworker, she says, "So this is what death's like?" And the caseworker says, "Well, it's very individual." To that person, points over to this person. She points to this person. She says, "For that person, that's what death is like. For this person, that's what death is like. For that person over there, that's what death." And it's all very individual. And it's kind of like that with rejecting the state or any other addiction. It's very individual. If you can analyze it in a way to see it and break it down in, like in the 12 steps that I was talking about, if you can do that, then that's a really good, the method of getting out of it. But some people don't have to do that. It's just like, oh yeah, state, I get it. Bad. Go away. Next thing, you know? That's kind of Ernie Hancock over at Freedom's Phoenix is kind of like that. It's like you present him with something and he's like, got it, let's move on.
Yeah.
And his mind is like that. It's just like, okay, addiction, got it, let's move on, next thing. But for other people, it's like, you know, they just struggle and struggle and struggle, and some people are never going to break out of it, and other people are going to fight their whole lives, and whether they win or not is, you know, it's almost a coin toss.
Yeah. So, yeah. But, yeah.
So, karma, it's not just a circle of what goes around comes around, huh?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's, you know, when a pawn in chess moves and then they get taken by a bishop, that was the pawn's karma. And now, not necessarily because it deserved, you know, to get taken by the bishop, but because it had made a move that made the bishop make the move. You know, and so these are all interconnected, and it becomes more difficult the more pieces that you have. You know, it's very easy when you have just a chessboard and you can see, okay, well, these are direct results. But with life, you don't really see that because there are so many indirect results that you have you don't even know are connected, much less how they're connected, you know? And so it becomes difficult to say, how do we bring forth this future that we want? And really the only way to do that is to examine yourself and say, am I choosing things that bring my path towards that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't really be bothered, you can't really be worried by other people's choices, because you don't have any control over that.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and it reminds me of the Who song, I'm Free, you know? Because he talks about how, you know, messiahs have opened the door and everyone's afraid to leave the temple. Mm. Like, if you want to be free, get up out of the temple, walk outside, and be free. And if you want to not be addicted to something, you have to put it down, walk away from it, and not be addicted anymore. And that's very easy to say, but it's very difficult to do. But the key is finding a way to be able to do that, because that's the only thing that matters. You know, you can sit there and say 1,000 times, oh, well, this is my last cigarette, this is my last, you know, whatever. But if you don't put it down, you're not quitting it, and you're still an addict, you know? And so, like, the talk around it doesn't matter. And I feel like a lot of times people fall into this trap where they've talked about things a lot. Like, they say, oh, well, we're so free, and we're so active in this, and we've done all this activism stuff. But it's a facade to avoid having to fix themselves and their inner addiction. You know, it's the way that Jehovah's Witness feels good about themselves and feels like they've connected to God by going and harassing their neighbors, instead of actually looking at, am I a godly person? You know, in my thoughts, in my actions, in my inner heart. Instead, they want to go convert others and think that that puts tally scores on their, you know, karmic whatever. But that's not the way karma works. You know, karma starts with your thoughts and your actions and the way that you move your puzzle piece, you know, your chess piece through the world. That's your karma. And you know, that's like with the activists in Keene. Are they bringing about liberty? Are they bringing about freedom? Are they freeing anybody's minds? You know, one third of the population will get it instantly and know. And you don't have to convince those people because they know. One third of the population not going to get it anyway. Like, they're just not going to be free. They're not ever going to be unaddicted from the state until the state is no longer there. So you can't help them anyway. So you're left with this middle third that you might actually have a chance of helping. These are the addicts that are helped by 12-step programs, and they're helped by, you know, nicotine patches, and they really can quit, but they need assistance quitting. And then you have to say, okay, are our actions actually helping those people quit? Or is this just theater, you know? Are we just a group of people all standing around saying we're going to quit smoking when we're smoking cigarettes actively, you know?
I think you hit on something really good there. And it might be, you know, coming from my perspective, wow, what was that?
I have no idea.
Okay. Anyway, I'll try to pick it back up there. So coming from my perspective, it's like, you know, I have been in one form or another, I have been in this battle since I was a teenager. Because when I was a teenager, you know, a lot like the way you were as a teenager, in the sense that you could see the nonsense of school. You could see how stupid it was. You could see aspects of society and of culture. And you maybe, like in my case, I hadn't necessarily put all the pieces of the puzzle together to realize what was wrong. But I knew something was terribly wrong. And in my case, like, I realized by the time that I was 16 that there was no such thing as legitimate law. Like, you know, I realized, like, okay, if you aggress upon someone, that's bad. That's wrong. That's in essence, that's the meaning of what real law is that you shouldn't aggress upon another person. But that's not what we call law in America. That's not what the government calls law. Law enforcement, those guys with badges and guns and cars and the whole theater that they present to us, that there's no legitimacy to that whatsoever. And it's not a matter of, well, we need to ratchet back police, or we need to get them, you know, to only do these good things, or we need to stop police brutality, or no. All of it, every single aspect, the moment you call them a cop, the moment that they take that job, all of it, every aspect of it is illegitimate and evil. There is no such thing as a good cop. They are all, by the very fact that they are cops, it is all evil. It is all, you know, literally coming from the devil. That's what it all is. And I understood that from the earliest days. But then again, I still didn't have all the pieces put together, but I guess my point in that is that I have been in this battle. I have been, you know, up to my knees in dead bodies, slinging back and forth with swords for 35 years now. And I look up and I say, why am I doing this? does it really matter? When I look at this, like what we're talking about here with these thirds, and these are, again, these are just rough numbers. A third of these people are not salvageable. They are not, I cannot help them. It's kind of like triage. I was on a rescue squad for a lot of years, and one of the early things they teach you when you start to go into any kind of a training like that, they teach you triage. So you look, you come into a disaster and you look around. If there are multiple victims of the disaster, then you have to be very cold-blooded and you have to be very logical in your thinking. You have to look at the guy whose guts are splattered all over the place and he's in horrible levels of pain, but he's still alive. And you have to just be really cold and look at him and go, there's nothing I can do to help that guy. And if I waste my time trying to comfort him, I might lose somebody else that I might be able to help. And so you have to, as much as your heart goes out and you want to help the guy who's in a tremendous amount of pain, if he's dying, you just have to go on to the next guy and let that one die. And then you have to, this hard decision. So which one can I help and do good for? And then you also have this other guy over here, and this is how they teach you in triage. You might have a guy over here with a splinter in his little finger, but he's crying like a baby and he's making a big, huge fuss and he's just a pain in the neck. He's demanding your attention. And what you want to do is slap him in the face and tell him, you stupid moron, sit down and shut up and leave me alone so I can do my job. That's what you want to do. But you can't. You have to balance between, you know, taking care of his splinter and helping the guy who's actually bleeding to death that you might be able to save his life if you can, you know, keep direct pressure. And one of the tricks is to try to get the guy with the splinter to help the guy who's bleeding to death. And if you can get him involved and get him to think past his pain, and think past the horrible trauma of having a splinter in his finger, then you can actually make him useful in your attempt to save the other guy's life. And that's the magic of triage. That's what the fantasy of is, the, if you can do that and save both of them and not have the tendency to want to just pull out a bayonet and shove it into the forehead of the guy with the splinter. You know, if you can overcome that urge and actually involve him into the rescue, then you've really accomplished the point. And sometimes, thinking of how long that I have been doing this and the intensity and the seriousness of it, sometimes I just want to stand up and walk away and let all these people bleed and just fold my arms and say, you know what? I think I'm going to go over here and watch the sunrise. And I'm not, to a certain extent, I can't do that. But to another level, at some point I have to do that. At some point I have to walk away and say, well, I've done everything I can do, and you people who are gonna bleed out, you're gonna bleed out. And you people who are gonna live, you're gonna live. And I have done all I can do for everybody else in the middle. And that's all I can do. Because otherwise, you know, one of the other things that we learned in disaster training, we specialized in mine rescue. One of the things that we really did a lot of training for was going into an unstable, underground setting and extracting a person from an unstable underground setting. And, one of the things that you want to do is you don't want to have your crew die in a mine that collapses around you as you're attempting to remove a person who's already dead, a dead body, or a person who's close to dead, who will probably die one way or the other, even if you get them out. There's no reason to risk losing a team just for body removal. And you have to actually be a little hard-hearted about it too and say, there, you can't risk losing your rescue team to get a guy out. You can't die in the rescue, because if you die in the rescue, maybe you'll rescue this one person, but there's 50 or 100 or 1,000 down the road that you'll never live to rescue. So the number one rule of rescue is you can't sacrifice yourself for the rescue, for any particular rescue. You have to live in order to get to the next rescue and the next one after that and the next one after that. Anyway.
But I think that's a great metaphor for, the the balance that is needed between the group and the self in life in general, you know, because on the one hand, you have to be independent and you have to be secure in yourself and you have to take care of yourself and you have to be responsible for yourself. And then there's also, you know, this responsibility to your community. And I get frustrated a lot when people value one over the other. You know, they say, you know, the sort of collectivist idea of the self doesn't matter and the only thing that matters is the group. But then you flip that and you have the hardcore, you know, individualist mentality that says the individual is the only thing that matters and the group doesn't matter at all and you can be totally self-sufficient without a group. And it's like humans need both. They need strong individuals who can take care of themselves in order to have a group that can take care of itself.
Yeah.
You know, like you have to have those two. And when you start veering into too much of one or the other, you start running into problems and humanity as a whole suffers because of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's a good metaphor.
So we probably ought to wrap this up. We're coming up on like an hour and a half of actual recording here. And probably 15 minutes that I have to cut out. What do you feel like? Do we need to, have we put a good enough bookend on the Bad Quaker podcast that we can shut it down with this one? Or do you think we need to, because you probably remember more of what I just now said than I do, because I'm not exactly, you know how my memory is.
Right.
If I don't have specific notes in front of me to cover specific points, then I don't know if I've covered them or not.
Right. I mean, I guess if we were going to close with this one, my closing remarks on the whole thing would be, don't focus so much on killing the state around you until you've killed the state in yourself.
That's really good. I like that. Kai, it's been a very interesting 4 years. We've been doing this podcast for 4 years next month. And a lot of things have happened. You know, it's been a long, strange trip.
that's very much for certain. I am definitely not the person I was 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yep. Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Goodbye.